From 90.9 WBUR, this is Radio Boston. I'm Scott Kirshner. Coming up, the state legislature sends a compromise energy bill to the governor. What does it mean for consumers and for renewable power in Massachusetts?
We have no wind farms, offshore wind farms, in America today. Massachusetts will be first to have a commercially scaled wind farm.
Plus, a look at innovation in women's health, from the history of the home pregnancy kit to the tampon of the future. Also today, the little-known sport of bee hunting with Cornell biologist Tom Seeley.
1, 2, 3 honeybees in the box and a bumblebee, which was caught just for fun.
And a look ahead to the Rio Olympics with the Boston Globe's Shira Springer. All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Scott Kirshner. It was a late night on Beacon Hill as the House and Senate raced against the clock to wrap up the session before the stroke of midnight, finalizing compromise bills to send to the governor's desk. And although some big ones fizzled, like a proposed tax on Airbnb rentals or restrictions on employee non-compete agreements, one major piece of legislation headed to Governor Baker is the state's renewable energy bill. It requires the state to buy much more power from hydro and offshore wind sources than ever before. So what would this law mean for your energy bill, for the environment, and the power production industry? We have two voices in the studio on this today. Peter Shattuck is director of the Clean Energy Initiative and director of the Massachusetts Office of the Acadia Group. Peter, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
And also Dan Dolan, president of the trade group New England Power Generators Association. Dan, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's start off with each of your reactions to the bill we wound up with yesterday. Peter, what's your take?
Well, I think overall this is a real win for clean energy. It's a win for Massachusetts. First, it's going to help reduce carbon pollution significantly, which we know we need to do to address the threat of climate change, to meet legal requirements to reduce climate pollution that were just confirmed by the highest court in the state. And it also helps diversify an energy mix that has become dangerously over-reliant on natural gas. We're getting towards approaching 60% of our energy from gas, and that's putting a lot of eggs in one basket. And finally, I think it's a win because it launches some really promising industries. Offshore wind is something that has yet to be developed at scale in North America, and that can happen out of Massachusetts. And also energy storage, which has an opportunity to be the next breakthrough technology to meet our energy needs.
Okay, and I want to talk about both of those things because we've certainly been talking about building wind turbines in Massachusetts for quite some time. But Dan, what's your take on the compromise bill from yesterday?
I think despite laudable goals of reducing emissions and preserving reliability, this has the potential to be the single largest rate increase facing Massachusetts consumers that we've ever seen in this state. And that's really for two main reasons. The first is that it carves up the marketplace. These contracts equate to roughly 40% of the electricity market in Massachusetts. It says for that 40% of the market, only these subset of resources can compete.
You mean the offshore wind or hydro are the only things that can
that's exactly
buy
right.
with that 40%?
That's exactly right. And layered on top of that are existing carve-outs that are around today for a renewable portfolio standard for what we consider the more traditional renewables, wind, solar, folks like that. And so if you combine it all together, we now have 60% of the market that is being carved up by the state, meaning that the power plants located here in Massachusetts and across New England can't compete for that. And that is going to increase costs for consumers.
And Dan, just as one follow-up, can you talk about the membership of the group you represent, New England Power Generators? I mean, are there companies in there that produce solar power or wind or hydro?
Absolutely. We represent roughly 85% of the generating capacity across the six states of New England. It's a comparable number here in Massachusetts. It's every different technology and fuel source, including a number of the wind farms, the majority of the solar capacity in Massachusetts. We also have all the nuclear plants, the vast majority of the natural gas, and all the other fuels and technologies that are out there.
I'm just curious, because you guys are obviously in different positions on this energy bill. Is there any common ground here? Is there anything, Peter, that you two agree on?
Well, I think there's a general unanimous sense that we need to address climate change. And so now the question is how. And I think it's complicated because the markets we have in place that Dan was referring to have produced a lot of benefits. We have low prices. We've seen some of the dirtier assets in terms of coal and oil coming offline. But now we face a real challenge that under business as usual, the market alone is only building natural gas. And we know to achieve our deep emissions reduction goals, to get to an 80% requirement that we have to get to, we need to start being a little bit more deliberate in the sources of energy that we support.
Okay, so I'm confused. When you talk about low cost, I've been seeing lots of estimates that energy costs in New England are like 39, 40% higher than the rest of the country. And WBUR did some reporting last winter that there were these spikes where, you know, it would go up 30 or 40% over average costs. So, Dan, why don't you chime in on, you know, do you agree on the low cost thing? And we kind of, it seems like we don't know yet what this bill is going to do to my average monthly bill at home, right?
Well, we've actually run some initial numbers looking at what were these types of procurements impact for consumers. And our view at a very high level is this would increase above the market price by $777 million per year for Massachusetts consumers. You multiply that over the decades-long contracts, we're talking roughly $20 billion in increased costs for consumers.
Okay, so that sounds like a big number. Are you getting around to what do you think it's going to be for, you know, my annual electricity costs or my monthly electricity costs?
You know, we actually haven't broken it down on an individual consumer basis. But regardless, we're talking about orders of magnitude, bigger than any rate increase that we've ever seen previously. But getting back to, I think, the fundamental point here, looking at how do we initiate some of the change that I think is recognized across the board. And Peter's right. We agree. We should be committed to reducing emissions. Power plants here in Massachusetts have cut carbon emissions by 51%, more than twice any other sector of the economy. We're willing to do more. But to get to the 80% reduction by 2050 that is in state law, it's also economy-wide. And at a certain point, we need to look at the other sectors of the economy, the biggest one being transportation. That's more than twice the carbon emissions of power plants and is the only sector of the economy in which emissions are actually rising.
And that you mean, by that you mean trucking and also our own cars driving around?
All of it.
Uh-huh. Peter, you wanted to chime in there on the cost question?
Yeah, the cost first. You know, there have been analyses on all sides of this. Is it going to drive costs up? Others would say it will bring costs down because once the projects, the wind and hydro are all online, they're basically producing fuel. They're producing electricity for free. They get their fuel for free. So they could bring down the electricity prices. I think one of the analyses that I thought really brought it home was something from the Union of Concerned Scientists that looked at a bill actually larger, but a similar shape to what was just passed, and found that it would be about $3 a month. And that was for more hydro, more offshore wind, and more other renewables. So if we just say, for purposes of illustration, it's maybe $1.50, $2, you know, that's a cup of coffee a month. And as a hedge against both climate change and over-reliance on natural gas, that doesn't seem like an unreasonable price to pay. And then just on the transportation point, I think it's a good one. But one of the main tools we have to reduce emissions in the transportation sector is through electric vehicles. Now, those vehicles need to run on as clean a source of electricity as we can get. So by cleaning up the power sector even more, we get more bang from the buck from reducing emissions with electric vehicles.
Assuming in the future more of us are driving electric cars than today. Dan, I'd love to ask you about the energy storage part of the bill and kind of what your take is there. So my understanding is we're talking about large-scale battery arrays or other storage technology that would store energy at times when there's high production and relatively low cost and be able to release it or have consumers use it at moments when, you know, you have an August heat wave or a January freeze. Is that something you view as a positive development that we're going to try to encourage that sort of energy storage?
Energy storage and electricity is the holy grail. To be able to deal with the intermittency that occurs right now with a lot of renewables when the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine, or as you put it, to deal with peak periods. that is really the game changer that so many folks and the smart institutions here in town are trying to address. I think it makes a lot of sense for the state to examine and explore different pilot programs to try and get there. The bill is a first step to do that. I think that makes sense. The biggest issue, however, is beyond that type of research, development, some initial deployment, is to get back to the core of this. We're talking about carving out wide swaths of the marketplace overall and saying that we know better than the market. We're going to pick what is the resource for the next 20 years that's going to supply 40 to 60% of our electricity, when the amount of technological change that occurs in this industry happens fast and unpredictably.
Right. Well, and that kind of gets us back to talking about offshore wind, right? Because Cape Wind was first proposed for Nantucket Sound in 2001. Now people say, oh, the technology has moved on. We shouldn't have built it. I mean, couldn't we sit around forever and say, let's not build wind farms or new solar arrays because the technology keeps getting better? Peter, I'd love for you to talk about the Cape Wind project. And it seems like this energy bill says, okay, we realize that Cape Wind and those nearshore wind farms, people don't love those. So let's do it further out, which is also a more expensive place to build wind farms.
Well, it is further out. It's in federal waters rather than state water. So it's basically out of sight from land. So it should deal with some of those local concerns.
The not in my backyard.
The NIMBY concerns.
Yeah.
A lot of folks would say the cost implications actually go in the other direction, that because this is a new project, they can use the new, larger, efficient wind turbines that they're now deploying in Europe out there, that the cost comes down. If you have to install fewer of these wind turbines, then the overall cost of electricity, the cost of these projects goes down. And, you know, to Dan's point about carving up the market, this is not saying we're going to do one project. This is another important distinction from Cape Wind. It's saying there will be competitive solicitations for contracts for offshore wind. So some of the biggest developers from Europe who've done this before are going to come in. They're going to have to compete with domestic companies. So there will be competition. It's really just bracketing the types of resources where we want to see competition and diversifying. I mean, I go back to 60% of the power from natural gas. That's a big risk to take, not just from a climate standpoint, but there's a history of price volatility. If that price goes up and we have all our eggs in that basket, that's a big problem.
And yet the irony is we're talking about competition, yet there would be only three companies that could compete for those offshore wind. And Cape Wind is actually specifically excluded from that competition, which is ironic given that they won their contract without any competition to begin with. But I think as if we... again, come back to the fundamental issue here. It's about us being smarter than the marketplace and saying for the next 20 years, we're going to lock into these types of technologies. When I think the more appropriate role right now is let's set the emission standard. Let's make it aggressive. Let's set the market standards that we want from a reliability and a pricing standpoint. And then let's figure out who can do it best. What's the innovative new technology? Who's the entity that can put their capital at risk and have competition take hold?
I'd love to see if we could get real quickly to the natural gas pipeline part of the energy bill. We have very little time left, but Peter, would you fill us in? And we've seen lots of protests around natural gas pipelines. The bill says utilities can still tack fees onto our monthly bills to pay for the construction. So are we going to continue to see both new natural gas pipelines and protests over where they're being built?
Well, actually, the legislation was silent on natural gas. And in effect, the outcome is what you described, that as it stands right now, utilities could impose this cost on electric ratepayers, on everyone who pays an electric bill. But this is being challenged at the Supreme Judicial Court. So there still are hurdles that this proposal would have to jump through. And I think that there's growing recognition about the risk of natural gas. And this clean energy bill itself should remove some of the motivation for building natural gas, because we're diversifying away from natural gas. We won't need as much. The need for this pipeline diminishes.
Great. Peter Shattuck, director of the Clean Energy Initiative and director of the Massachusetts office of the Acadia Group, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Dan Dolan, president of the New England Power Generators Association, thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Scott Kirshner. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Scott Kirshner. When a new invention was introduced in the United States back in the late 70s, there were some concerns about the consequences. Unmarried teenagers would jump off of bridges. Doctors would feel their authority was being undermined. Women would neglect prenatal care. And their state of emotional anxiety would prevent women from following the simplest instructions. All those things were concerns about the havoc that the home pregnancy test could wreak on society. Now, however, 8 in 10 women learn they're pregnant through a test purchased from the drugstore. In a recent New York Times piece, Pagan Kennedy dove into the history of the home pregnancy test. She also wrote about the smart tampon back in April, and she joins us now to talk about innovation in women's health. Welcome to Radio Boston, Pagan.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
So we mentioned some of the reactions to the home pregnancy test when it first got introduced in the 70s, but let's talk about the story of Margaret Crane, who invented the home pregnancy test. Tell us about her.
I actually did an earlier piece about home pregnancy testing, and I was trying to track down the person who was the originator of this idea because I thought it was so brilliant. And at that time, that was 2012, and I couldn't find the source of that idea. And after my piece came out, I got an email from this woman, Meg Crane, and she actually did hold the earliest patent on this home pregnancy test idea. And then, so she told me her whole story, and it's really like something out of Mad Men. She was living in the Greenwich Village in the 1960s, very much an artist and a liberated woman, and she worked at a pharmaceutical company in New Jersey. And one day she was walking through their lab, and she saw these sort of little kits, and they told her this was something that they would... Doctors would send in urine from women and they would test it there for urine samples. And her first thought was, why can't women do this themselves? It didn't look that complicated.
Uh-huh.
So she basically went home and she had this plastic paperclip box, dumped the paperclips out and built a prototype inside of it. And then showed it to her bosses, who universally said it was stupid. this was 1967, and that there was, no need for it. That what if only teenage girls would want it? They might commit suicide. Doctors would hate it.
And the idea was that this company, Organon, was developing pregnancy tests that were going to be sold to doctors. They didn't even have the consumer market in mind. Right.
And it was almost the same technology because the doctors weren't lab techs, But it happened that Organon's parent company was in the Netherlands, where people were a lot more liberal about women's health. So the Netherlands, the bosses in the Netherlands wanted to go ahead with it. And when her bosses did talk about it, sort of took it on as their idea. Once the big bosses approved it. And so she then had to really fight for not only her ownership of the idea, but her vision for the idea.
And you tell this amazing story where she has to sneak into a boardroom meeting at the company at Organon when they're deciding about the eventual design of the test. She brings her prototype in and she actually meets her future husband at that meeting.
Yes. She wasn't invited to come to the meeting. Because nobody remembered at this point the whole thing was her idea, but she had made the best prototype. They brought in all these other designers who thought, well, women would need things covered with frilly tassels and flowers and things, which really is not a very good idea when you're testing urine, right? And she had this nice, clean, beautiful lab kit that she was making for women. So it ended up being the only one that was even practical. And so they had to patent it under her name.
And the initial slogan that they used for marketing the home pregnancy test was, every woman has the right to know whether or not she's pregnant. I mean, that sounds kind of obvious.
Yes.
Today.
Well, that was wildly feminist back then. And that was actually, Meg Crane ended up living with the advertising manager for the test, who was really her champion. He came up with that slogan. She did the technology. And together they introduced the product in Canada in 1971. And so Canadian women had access to it, even while it would take many, many more years for Americans to get this product.
Meg Crane said to you that women and even some men still come up to her and thank her for inventing the test. So what did they tell her?
Well, she, after very recently, she decided to come forward. She's so modest that most of her friends didn't even know she did this. But she auctioned off her original kit to the Smithsonian. So now she's been acknowledged. And so she got some press out of that. And hopefully out of my article, she'll get a lot more.
I'm sure. Another article of yours back in April, you wrote about the tampon of the future, which has roots here in Boston.
Right.
MIT and Harvard Business School alumna Reedy Tarial, who kind of strikes me as a modern day Meg Crane. So tell us her story.
Well, I think what's so brilliant about Reedy's idea is that for a long time, a lot of companies have wanted to give us blood tests at home. Well, the problem with that is you need a lot of blood. And who wants to, you know, create a vial of blood at home? That's just None of us are going to do that, right?
Yeah.
So that's been the hitch that's really keeping us from home blood testing. And it seemed like this was sort of insurmountable. And then Reedy had this idea one day, what about menstrual blood? And I think this is the importance of having female engineers. This idea that just didn't occur to, you know, decades and decades of engineers who were almost entirely male. And as she actually and her business partner, Stephen Geyer, as they began researching this and developing the idea, they realized they could create a tampon that would also be a medical device that would. Turns out that menstrual blood has all kinds of cells in it shed by our reproductive system, by the ovaries and so on and so forth. So it's a very, very exciting new potential to collect these cells that you would otherwise it would not be easy to get at and test them for cancer.
Uh-huh. And not just diagnosing disease like cancer, but also monitoring fertility and potentially some other applications as well.
Exactly. So it would be kind of a monthly monitor of everything that's going on in your fertility system and just letting you know if you haven't, you know, if you have a sexually transmitted disease, if you have fertility problems, if anything's amiss. And so that's the vision. And they are starting with monitoring endometriosis. That's kind of the easiest thing to solve right now. So they're actually doing clinical trials right now.
And you noted that she had some discouraging early meetings with funders about this technology at first. And we should note that I think that analysis says 96% of the venture capital funding world is male. So what happened at some of those meetings?
Yeah. And, you know, this was this opened my eyes as a reporter because I always thought, oh, well, the problem is there aren't enough female engineers and stuff. But I think the real bottleneck is that the funders are very homogenous, white males. And so, you know, when she and Stephen pitched their idea to potential funders, several of them said, well, how can this be a product for men? You know, it would only help women. So what good is that? So can you turn it around into a product for men, which just sort of boggles the mind of how
it'd be hard to market a smart tampon to men, but maybe it could be done. I don't know.
So they had a lot of hitches there. And eventually what happened was they got some female investors who were very supportive of them. And that really helped.
So, I mean, is the insight here that whether we're talking about the development of home pregnancy testing or the future of tampons, that, you know, the innovation in technology world today is too focused on things that, you know, maybe a narrow slice of people are obsessed with, whether it's virtual reality goggles or driverless cars or things like that, and that you want to see us broaden the spectrum of things that get developed and people who are developing them?
Exactly. You know, I think that we could have any kind of technological world with any kind of goals we wanted. You know, we could put a lot more effort into, say, women's health if that was our desire. And so I really want to make people think about the technological world that could exist. And to have the listeners right now think about, well, what do I want to exist that doesn't exist? And I think we feel very passive about it. If it doesn't, you know, we don't really know how these things come into being. And You know, I think we all have kind of an obligation to get involved with the innovation stream and make our ideas known and really push for things that shouldn't exist.
And so these two examples that we've been talking about, are there others that you've identified and you're going to write about and you're focusing on as, hey, there's a whole wide world here of innovation for populations and maybe people who live in certain parts of the world that are starting to happen and you know, will happen more if we get kind of more diverse investors behind them?
Yeah, well, there's an inventor here at MIT, Amy Smith, who's really made it her life's work to think about what do inventions look like when we privilege the half of the world who makes under $2 a day? What does technology look like when we think about that audience and solving their problems and also bringing the brilliant people in Africa and Haiti who just don't have access to the technology stream into the process to contribute their ideas? There's that. There are amazing patient communities emerging on the internet where people are coming together to say, yeah, there's not a very good off-the-shelf solution to this. We're just going to fix it ourselves. Like diabetes patients now are reinventing glucose monitors. And that's very exciting, you know.
For sure. It's going to be interesting to see where things go. Peggy Kennedy is a contributor to The New York Times. Her forthcoming book is Inventology, How We Dream Up Things That Change the World. For a link to her articles on the home pregnancy test and the smart tampon, you can go to our website, radioboston.org. Pagan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
A Boston clinic for transgender youth has noticed something that it can't explain. A high percentage of those children and teenagers are growing up in adoptive homes. In fact, the rate of adoption among the clinic patients turns out to be 3 to 4 times higher than the overall adoption rate in Massachusetts. WBUR's Martha Biebinger has this report on what this might tell us about transgender young people and adults.
2 summers back, when Nathan Tasker was 13, his mom drove him from Melrose to Maine for a special transgender camp. Nathan said he was happy for the first time in years.
I finally was not alone.
But even here, Nathan expected to be different because he's transgender and adopted.
Well, I thought that, you know, I was just a package deal. Like, this only happens to one kid, like, in every place in the world. But I was like, you know what? There are a lot of adopted kids who are trans, and that's pretty amazing.
Doctors at Boston Children's Hospital Gender Management Service Clinic, where Nathan is a patient, started making the same connection last year.
We had been noticing that a seemingly high percentage of our patients were adopted or living with adoptive families.
Dr. Daniel Schumer treated transgender kids at Boston Children's Hospital for 3 years. He moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan to open a similar program last year, but pored through the files in Boston before he left. He found that 8.2% of the 184 young people who've come to the clinic since it opened in 2007 were raised in adopted families. The adoption rate overall in Massachusetts is 2.3%.
There may be a true link between being adopted and being transgender. But another possibility is that adoptive families may be more likely to present to clinics for help for their transgender child.
There are a few reasons why. Adoption experts say it's a fact. Adopted children seek and receive more counseling and care. When it comes to transgender care, Schumer says families of adopted children appear less likely to be ashamed of their child and more likely to seek help. That idea resonates with Dr. Johanna Olson Kennedy, who runs a clinic for transgender youth in Los Angeles.
When parents have biological children that are transgender, what happens is a big blame game. I've heard many families say, well, you know, my husband has 2 gay cousins or my wife has a trans aunt.
Olson Kennedy says that doesn't usually happen with the families of adopted kids. But could there be something about the experience of adoption that helps explain the link? Dr. Schumer says maybe.
As adoptive kids are becoming teenagers, they may more actively consider their gender identity in the context of their overall identity than kids that aren't adopted, that aren't going through as rigorous an identity thought process.
That's a new but reasonable thought, says Adam Pertman, president of the National Center on Adoption and Permanency.
Identity and adoption is a complex issue. I mean, it's complex for everybody, but there's a whole nother layer for adopted people that sort of triggers, in many of them, a deeper look within themselves about identity. And maybe this is part of what they find.
I think it's a stretch, frankly.
Jamison Green, the immediate past president of the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, says all of these theories are interesting guesses, but just that.
People, in trying to understand what transness is and how it manifests and why some of us are this way, will elicit all kinds of conjectures.
Green has many of his own questions. He is, after all, adopted. Could there be something triggered by an early separation from the biological mother, or something neurological linked to reasons a mother gives her child up for adoption?
It speaks to how little we actually know. There's much more to be learned about transness, about gender identity development in all people.
There appears to be just one other study on transgender adoption rates. In 1998, a Toronto clinic found a similarly high percentage of adoption among transgender youth than among children as a whole. The Boston researchers are presenting their findings at conferences and have submitted a paper for publication. It leaves the question about why there's a higher rate of adoption among transgender youth seen at some clinics open for discussion.
WBUR's Martha Biebinger. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Scott Kirshner. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Scott Kirshner. The Summer Olympics kick off this Friday in Rio. Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the Boston Globe's sports section, heads to Brazil tomorrow. Rio 2016 is going to be her fifth time covering the Olympic Games, and she joins us now. Welcome, Shira.
Hello.
So you wrote in the Globe this past weekend about some of the athletes that you're going to be keeping an eye on. I'm curious who is on your list.
Well, number one, I think you have to start with Usain Bolt. He's going for a triple in track and field, which means he is trying to win the 100, the 200, and the 4x100 relay with his Jamaican teammates for the third Olympics in a row. I was lucky enough to be there when he sort of debuted. It wasn't his first Olympics, but when he was sort of his coming out party in Beijing in 2008. And he is just this incredibly charismatic personality. He is everything you would want an Olympic champion to be, first of all, as a reporter, but I think also as a fan. You know, he has his famous lightning bolt pose that he does after every win. So he's definitely one of the people I'm keeping an eye on. And I think I, along with many, if not all of Brazil, will be keeping an eye on Marta, a women's soccer star, and Neymar, male soccer star for Brazil. They have a chance to bring home gold in the soccer tournaments for men and women for the first time for Brazil. Brazil, believe it or not, has never won the Olympic soccer tournament. So that would be huge in their home country.
And the U.S. women's basketball
yes.
team, you have a prediction there as well?
Gold, because they really haven't done much else besides win gold. I think they're riding something like a 41-game winning streak entering these Olympics. So it will take an awful lot. And if the U.S. women were to lose in basketball, it would be probably the upset of the games, maybe even perchance bigger than the men's basketball team losing, my opinion.
Okay, and this maybe ties into the conversation that we've all been having this weekend about Muslims in the U.S. We also have the first U.S. Olympic athlete who's going to compete in a hijab.
Yeah, Ibtihaj Mohammed, very, very big role model for, I would say, Muslim girls and women who want to be involved in athletics, but also for women generally, just an incredible pioneer in her sport. And she took up fencing because it's one of the few sports where she can wear the hijab and not get stares from people in the crowd. And then she saw that she had an incredible talent for it. So a huge moment when she will take to the saber competition.
So there's been a lot of negative press in advance of the Olympics this year.
Just a little.
But we always hear questions about, are the facilities ready? Is the infrastructure there? Can it handle the crowds? But what do you see as some of the biggest issues that are still surrounding Rio 2016?
Well, first of all, everything you just mentioned is on the table for Brazil. I think one of the big issues now is security, because, first of all, there are now reports that Rio officials did not hire the security firm charged with monitoring the checkpoints in and out of venues until July 1st. So that gave them roughly three and a half weeks to hire and train up a whole squad of security officials that will be at the front lines for these Olympics. So security is a big concern. I think venues and the quality of the infrastructure is a big concern. Of course, you can't talk about Brazil without mentioning Zika concerns. I mean, you can run down the list. Transportation is a big concern. A number of the subway lines that were supposed to be completed in advance of the games to ferry all the thousands upon thousands of fans between different venue clusters are not completed. So where do all these people go? And the traffic wasn't great to begin with without the Olympics. So a lot of issues to
contend
with.
As someone who's traveling tomorrow to Rio, did you have to make any special preparations this time around that you didn't do when you went to Beijing or when you went to London?
Well, I'm traveling with five bottles of mosquito repellent. So, yes, and I've purchased clothing that is sort of, I guess, been treated with mosquito repellent just to be on the safe side there. I think I'm also just a little bit more aware of the geography of Rio. For example, when I would get to Vancouver, London, I would sort of explore the city and see what was out there and kind of get to know it firsthand. Now I'm briefing myself on the city, where there are areas that I should go, should be able to go safely, where are areas that I should avoid. If I'm not taking official Olympic transportation, I'm thinking more about the routes that I'm going to travel using public transportation. So I think a little bit more forethought in terms of logistics on my part than in past Olympics.
There was this Associated Press analysis of the water in the sailing and rowing venues in Rio that found really high levels of bacteria and viruses, basically from untreated sewage in the water.
It's sort of like raw sewage with a little bit of water as opposed to water with raw sewage, it seems.
It sounds that way. I mean, you have people saying it's fine, just don't put your head underwater, or don't fall out of
your
boat.
Don't come in contact with water. Don't get caught. I mean, you're having rowers and sailors being told, be careful of, you know, spray from the water. And so, I'm thinking to myself, that's part of the competition.
So are these events going to happen and teams will just deal with it?
These events are going to happen. I know that several rowing teams have gotten special uniforms, for lack of a better word. They're really jerseys that are long sleeve jerseys so that when they train, their skin isn't as exposed to the water as it might ordinarily be. I've heard some coaches simply express let's call it an extreme amount of concern about their athletes. And while luck is involved with all competitions, I think there's the feeling more this time around, particularly in the water-based sports, that you're going to have to be both good and lucky, because lucky in the sense that you're not getting any water, you know, transfer disease prior to your competition.
I think I would be wearing one of those fencing uniforms if I were on the
that would be
team.
You might be a trendsetter with that.
Maximum coverage. So as a journalist going down, I mean, do you have any concerns about your accommodations or the media center? I think we were reading about some of the issues with team accommodations not really feeling complete or safe.
Yeah, I mean, I think oddly enough, usually it's the athletes who are sort of the best taken care of and they don't have to worry about a thing and you're sort of catered to. But they are, as you mentioned, having some real extreme problems with electrical exposed wiring and some plumbing problems in the athletes' village. Thankfully, from all that I've heard about my hotel, it's standing. It's in one piece. Everything functions properly there. And I think the rest of it's sort of a wait and see. Are we going to have, you know, reliable Wi-Fi? Are the, you know, electronics going to work the way they should? But that's how it is with every Olympics. You go to these cities, they're doing this for the first time. There are an incredible number of unknowns, and you just kind of have to go there and embrace the adventure of it all.
I want to end with a quick upbeat note here, maybe back to the sport. So what's the one thing that you're most looking forward to about this year's games?
Okay, besides Usain Bolt, what am I most... I think I just want to experience the Brazilian culture. I've actually had an invitation to go samba dancing one night, so I'm going to take that person up on going to samba dancing. I want to get out and see Ipanema and Copacabana. I think there's a real rich culture there. I've heard wonderful things about the Brazilians and how friendly they are. Despite the protests and all the problems plaguing these Olympics, I think there's going to be an incredibly warm embrace from the Brazilian people. So I'm interested in just diving in and experiencing not just the athletic events, but the celebration of the city and Brazilian culture.
All right. Well, we should mention that Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe, is going to be checking in with us from Rio throughout the Olympics. And you can find a link to her Olympics preview on radioboston.org.
Yeah, I'll Shira. Give you an update on my samba dancing skills.
Right, please do. Thank you, Shira.
You're welcome.
So let's turn now to a sport that hasn't made it to the Olympics just yet, bee hunting. Yes, there are people that hunt bees, but they don't hurt the insects or mount trophies above the mantle. They simply follow them to find their hive. The activity goes all the way back to Rome, 1000 AD, but it's now being used to help answer questions about how to protect our increasingly imperiled bees. Massachusetts relies on bees to pollinate crops on nearly half of its farmland, but an increasing number of the colonies have been suffering from collapse each winter. Bee hunters hope hunting wild bees might tell us more about how we can prevent those large-scale deaths. Joining us now to explain more is Tom Seeley, a professor of biology at Cornell University and avid bee hunter. His new book is Following the Wild Bees, The Craft and Science of Bee Hunting. Tom, welcome.
My pleasure to be here, Scott. Thank you for inviting me.
I have to admit, today is the first day that I heard about bee hunting. So what is it and how do you do it?
Well, it works in the following way. The bee hunter starts his search for a wild colony, and I'm reading from my book here, starts his search for a wild colony by catching bees on flowers and then baiting them to forage at a small bonanza of sugar syrup that he has bewitchingly scented with anise. Next, he determines the direction to the bees' secret residence from the paths of their homeward flights. Then he gradually moves his sugar syrup feeder, together with the bees, down their flight line home, their bee line. Finally, he zeroes in on their mysterious dwelling place, some hollow tree, old building, or abandoned hive.
I love that part of the introduction to your book. So this is about finding where the bees live, but it started off as a technique for finding honey, right? And people would take the hives or often take the whole tree with them?
Oh, yes. This is a technique or an activity, a craft that goes back to before probably even we were humans. It's been done for 50, 100,000 years and was done originally by humans to get the honey from wild colonies and to get their brood. And in some cultures, the hunter-gatherer cultures that still exist, at certain times of the year, it's a huge and very important part of their caloric intake.
So as a fan of honey, I feel like I have to ask, in bee hunting in 2016, if you find the colony, are you not allowed to take honey from it? Is that outside the rules of bee hunting?
Well, it's not. There really aren't any rules to this bee hunting, Scott, so it's up to the individual. But today it's so much easier to buy honey from a beekeeper. I don't think that bee hunters most bee hunters wouldn't want to go to the trouble of cutting open the tree and ladling out the honey or just harvesting. It's a lot of work.
So in the book you say that you can get started with bee hunting with a kit that costs $28.12. So it's a very specific number. What's in the kit?
Well, first of all, that number comes from what Henry David Thoreau spent to build his house out at Walden Pond. So that was a good reference point. He was an avid bee hunter himself. So that's that link. What's in your kit is something the most important tool is a little device called a bee box, which is something you build yourself. So it's basically free. It's a little device you use to capture bees off of flowers and introduce them to this rich food source, which is your bait. The other items in the kit are very simple. They would be, the most expensive item is a magnetic compass. So when you sight the flight directions of the bees, you have a number. And then there's some paint pens, a jar of sugar water, might be a jam jar, and a notebook, and of course your pencil, and so that's about it.
And is this your bee kit that you brought into the studio? It's a wooden box, kind of not much bigger than maybe two bricks stacked on top of each other?
Yes, and this is my bee box, the one that I've been using for 40 years in my scientific investigations of the wild colonies of bees.
So what got you started in bee hunting?
What got me started, Scott, was recognition of a gap in our knowledge of the natural history of Apis mellifera, the honeybee. And that gap was just what is the abundance of colonies living in the wild? Honeybees live both in two situations. One is in the managed hives of beekeepers, but also in the wild. And they go back and forth between these two groups. And we knew a lot about how many colonies are living in the wild in the United States, but we had no idea how many were living out in the wild. And it turns out there's probably more living in the wild than even under the beekeeper's management.
You have an anecdote in the book about Henry David Thoreau, and I think the first time maybe that he went bee hunting, and they found some bees that were living in managed hives at that time in the 19th century, right? They didn't find wild bees that day.
Yeah, on that particular day, they caught bees off flowers. It was September 30th, 1852, I think, and the lines that they established caught those flowers on a bank by Walden Pond. All three lines that they established pointed back to known hives in Concord. So they, Thoreau was still excited to realize that, you can track down a colony this way. But in this case, they were the managed hives of three beekeepers.
So we talked at the beginning about honeybee colony collapse and disease. So how does what you're doing help beekeepers keep these bees healthy?
It gives us a reference point, Scott, and it also shows us how bees can survive without being treated with insecticides or pesticides. As you mentioned at the beginning of the program, beekeepers are experiencing very high percentages of colony deaths over the winter. This can be usually, now it's more than 30%, can be 50%. And the source of that is an introduced parasitic mite, which spreads viruses and changes the disease ecology of these viruses, so they're much more virulent than they used to be. And the solution beekeepers use now is to treat their colonies with acaricides to knock down the mite populations and control the viruses. Well, the honeybee colonies that are living in the wild don't get those treatments, and yet they are surviving just fine. And so they offer us, by studying them, we can learn an alternative solution whereby honeybee colonies can live healthily without being treated with acaricides, pesticides.
I have to ask the obvious question just because a young member of my family was stung over the weekend. So the question is, have you ever been stung in all these years of bee hunting?
I don't think I've ever been stung bee hunting, Scott. And the reason for that, I have been stung as a beekeeper. I'm a beekeeper as well as a bee hunter. I don't get stung as a bee hunter. And you might wonder, why is that? It's because in contrast to beekeeping, where you're actually opening up the bee's hive or nest, you're disturbing the bees. When you're bee hunting, you're doing just the opposite. You're offering them some goodies, and they're happy to come and visit you. So they're peaceful and calm. And so bee hunting, a feature of bee hunting, in addition to the fact that it's cheap, is the fact that you don't get stung.
Much less dangerous than beekeeping.
Yes, indeed.
Would you tell us about, is there a day for you that stands out as the halcyon day of bee hunting in your career so far?
Oh, great question. Well, maybe so. I had a wonderful bee hunt up at my camp in Maine last August. It's not in my book, but it was one where I started my bee hunt in a field of goldenrod by my house in Pembroke, Maine. And the bees, bless them, shot out across the river, across an estuary, a half-mile-wide body of water, over to woods on the adjacent peninsula. And over the next couple of days, I lined my way back to that tree. And it was a spruce tree up on a ledge, dead old spruce tree. And there's nothing quite like the experience, Scott, of being able to track your way back using simple tools and your patience and your good vision and a few other skills to find that really needle in a haystack or tree in a forest that is the home of the bees. It's a huge high, a huge thrill to achieve that.
So I noticed that you're married. You're wearing a wedding band, but you dedicate your book instead of maybe a partner, spouse, to the honeybees that live in Arnott Forest. So where is Arnott Forest?
The Arnott Forest is a research forest owned by Cornell University. And in that is the location where I've studied for 40 years the population of wild honeybee colonies. And it's that population that is revealing to us the secrets by which wild honeybee colonies are able to survive without chemical treatments. And for example, what we're learning is that they've changed genetically, they've gone through very strong natural selection, and they have a lifestyle that's very healthy as well.
Well, Tom, thanks so much for being here. Tom Seeley is a professor of biology at Cornell University. His new book is Following the Wild Bees: The Craft and Science of Bee Hunting. Tom, thanks.
You're most welcome, Scott. My pleasure.
That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Scott Kirzner. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.